Chapter 20 The Legend of the Forsaken. When it comes to playing politics, no one does it better than the Ramirans. Don't misunderstand me. There are plenty of peoples who are better at playing politics than the Ramirans, else the incipient kingdom would have had a Ramiran monarch and not a Castali. What I mean is that Ramirans do it better than anyone else. They would much rather persuade you with praise and pampering than threaten you with rat tails and revenge killings. I'm new to the political arena, but I like the way the Ramirans do business. When Ramir was the ass-end outpost of the empire, the second-to-last stop before Faris, the duchy had begun as a scenic ring of port cities on the coast, connected to some lucrative upriver plantations. But it had also achieved a certain shabbily cosmopolitan feel, from the number of majocracy exiles, self-imposed and the regular kind, who had settled there. Esoteric cults, dispossessed imperial noblemen, itinerant magi, wandering clerics, scholars in search of inspiration, artists, adventurers, reformed pirates, and ambitious younger sons eager to build their fortune. The exotic mix of adventurers and extremists had given Ramir a sense of self-importance that the equally exotic, but far less cultured, Castali port cities across the bay had never achieved. After the conquest opened up the interior of the continent, much of that culture had moved upriver with the imperial refugees attempting to flee toward the perceived safety of Wenshar. The first Narasi dukes put a stop to that flight and forced the imperials to settle into the feudal society they were familiar with, whether they wanted to or not. But the legacy of the cosmopolitan coastal culture and their exuberant, decadent, and sensuous approach to everything continued to affect the Ramirans, regardless of where they settled. The Ramirans enjoyed life, no matter their wealth or station. Even the half-naked, destitute, land-bound peasantry who worked the great plantations had adopted the philosophy, and it was reflected in everything from their cuisine to their religion. That affected their approach to politics, too, I discovered at the meeting. When the Order of the Secret Tower invited me to a special meeting, escorted by my steward, Penny, they had a captive audience and they could have begun and likely concluded the negotiations right away, and saved everyone a lot of time. But that's not the Ramiran way. While the Order was not exclusively Ramiran, I had been told, it was Ramiran enough that we couldn't even get through introductions without a buffet table and three stark, naked, golden-brown serving girls dispensing the first of many rounds of exotic liqueurs. The principals who wished to meet with me wore pale yellow robes, about as sombre a thing as I've seen a Ramiran wear, with what I could only assume was the secret tower's secret sigil embroidered over the breast. Each principal, and there were nine, had an aide-de-camp and two additional servants, and several had scribes or other hangers-on. Each mage in attendance reclined on a short, wooden-bottomed squatting cushion that had once been popular in the majocracy, with plenty of space before them to allow wine servers and food servers and body servants to attend to their every want and desire, while sweet, soothing music played and savoury incense and spring flowers scented the air. And this was a simple business function. I was led to my spot, a place of honour in the circle, and Penny was led to the spot to my left. There were some confusing introductions, but I was getting used to putting names and faces together for political purposes. By the third drink and the second round of appetizers, I had a rough idea of who everyone was and who they were in the order. All of them were well-respected magi, most of them practical adepts or court magi, with a few well-respected arcane scholars thrown in. Penny's father, Osirigo, was a senior member, as was the deputy court mage of Ramir. An older woman, Mistress Letuandwa, was from a coastal family of magi so rich and powerful that they rarely even did magic for pay anymore. She reminded me of an apple left in the sun too long. Penny's cousin, Planos, had a seat in the ring, although he made do with just one retainer and an assistant, plus two girls to keep him from starving to death. Despite his paltry retinue, plenty of his peers glared at his place of note. His fortunes had risen rapidly, in time with his cousins. I could sense some resentment from others in the room who felt he had not earned a place. It didn't seem to bother him. Behold the embassy of the order, a masked figure of some importance intoned as he struck a little bell. Master Osirigo stood and faced me. Master Minellan, you have repaid the debt we extended to you in your hour of need far beyond all hope, he said reverently. You have more than acted in good faith. You have acted to destroy the shackles placed unjustly upon us, he said, diplomatically not mentioning the fact that it was my ancestors who were responsible for those shackles in the first place. As you know, our order is descendant from the Privy Council of the ancient Majocracy. It was from among the ancestors of our order that the Arch Magi were chosen, and while that office became a tool to run the secular affairs of the Majocracy, the Privy Council was always concerned as well with certain legacies of our ancestors. Legacies from lost Perwin. And then we broke for a snack. Some sort of miniature pears, cooked in wine, honey, cinnamon, and bernuan. Apparently you were supposed to eat them with your fingers. You've intrigued me, I admitted, as I licked my fingers clean. It was that good, and that's not considered a violation of protocol amongst the casual Ramirans. In my struggle against the dead god, I would have the might of our ancestors on our side. I said legacies from Perwin, Master, he corrected, not necessarily might. For within the vast records our order managed to keep from destruction, while there are certainly spells of great power, there are other legacies less practical, but no less important. I'm just an ignorant, backwards spellmonger, I shrugged. You're going to have to be a lot less vague than that. Let's put all of our pieces on the table, shall we? I've always wondered, just what is it your order is supposed to do? Osirigo looked around, received a few grudging nods, and then continued. Among our many responsibilities is one of the most sacred, admitted Osirigo, twirling his mustache. It is the matter of the Forsaken. He paused, apparently waiting for lightning or a crash of thunder or a gasp of breath to complete the drama of the revelation. Since I had never heard of the Forsaken before, the desired effect was lost on me. So who are the Forsaken? Penny prompted impatiently. Let's skip the poetry, Daddy, and just tell him it's been a long day. Osirigo huffed, but agreed. Our ancestors on Perwin had many arcane magics. Most of them we only barely understand in our ignorant age. But there were some things that were particularly important to them, and one of the things the ancient Perwinese Majocracy was concerned with was the Forsaken. And the Forsaken were, well, we're not sure. Not sure? I found that hard to believe. Oh, there are whole books on the Order's duties to the Forsaken, how it's our sacred responsibility to faithfully guard the rites and regalia. The matter is always treated with the utmost reverence, but as to what or whom the Forsaken actually were, we are unsure. But they're important, I said, trying to figure this out. Without a doubt, he assured me. And they're powerful, I added, half asking. They are referred to as having the ultimate powers. Destruction, dissolution. There's plenty of different ways they say it, but the Privy Council was clearly both afraid and respectful of the Forsaken. Why were the Forsaken forsaken? I asked. That's when the ducal court mage, Master Gorthus, hobbled forward and began reading from a scroll. Before the time of the first Archmage, control of Perwin was splintered into several great and mighty powers, he recited. As the Void spawned humanity unto Perwin, and it constituted itself in its new home, it had to contend with the great and fearful leviathans of the Seafolk, and the caprices of the Gavanni, and the shifting alliances of the Elca'alon, and the other dangers of Kalidor. Among these powers who shared the rule of Perwin were those who had made great study of the magics of the Elca'alon, and when they demonstrated their newfound spells to their fellows, many of the other powers on Perwin were against them. There were struggles and battles, but in the end the Magi, as they had styled themselves, had been threatened with dissolution and destruction by the Forsaken. From what we have learned from these, the eldest of our writings, either side could summon the Forsaken to judge them, and the Magi feared that judgment, the old wizard explained.
They sound like gods,
Penny observed, or demons. What do the gods say about them? She asked. Precious little, my lady, Master Gorthus admitted. They are mentioned but a handful of times in the histories of the gods. Mayhap there are yet ancient scrolls still lurking in the vaults of Vor and Merwin, but the gods themselves, it is said, feared the judgment of the Forsaken. I whistled in appreciation. The gods feared little, from what I understood. These Forsaken sounded like mighty warriors. So just what is the Order's position on the Forsaken? I asked. Of course they couldn't just answer me. A chime rang, signalling that it was time for a wine course. An iced white wine from Drisine, served in snow from the mountains with a wedge of lemon on the side, was brought out and served with great ceremony and a flute solo. While we sipped the delicate beverage, two jugglers threw flaming daggers around the room while a drummer and a piper played. That's one of the things we're unsure of, continued Osirigo quietly, while we drank. We have the initial rituals of summoning, but they are arcane to the point of insensibility, and require a number of unlikely things from a number of places to be performed. Ultimately, the mage who dares summon the Forsaken must go to the sunken spires of Perwin itself. Osirigo sounded apologetic. I wish we knew more about their nature, Master Minolin, but so much has been lost to us over the years. That was the nicest way I had ever heard someone refer to my book-burning, mage-hating ancestors. These Remirans turned ass-kissing into an art form. Yet your order has a duty to summon them. Osirigo shrugged. We think so, but we could be wrong. It could be that we are to guard Kalador against their fury. I pondered a moment. Well, the Forsaken are an unknown variable. The dead god is known all too well, I said, thinking of the butchery at Timberwatch. At the moment I can fight him, but I have no clear way to defeat him. The Forsaken sound like they might have the power to do so. If the gods themselves were afraid of them, maybe the dead god will be too. That's certainly a possibility, Master Gorthus admitted. Then again, if they find common cause and ally against us, Pentandra pointed out, then all of Kalador shall fall between them. This, too, is a possibility, Gorthus agreed. You're not exactly inspiring a lot of confidence, I grimaced. If your order doesn't know exactly what its duty is in relation to the Forsaken, then why do you pursue the matter so rigorously? Because we know it's very important, stressed Osirigo. Our top priority, assured Gorthus. We seek to fulfill our obligation to the Forsaken, if there is one, regardless of what it might be. That has been the goal to which the Order always pledged itself, offered Mistress Letawandua, speaking for the first time in a voice that sounded like a bullfrog. What else should we do with all of this old stuff?
And you need Irionite to do that duty, whatever it is, I ventured. I take it Irionite is absolutely essential.
Of course, Osirigo said. It was the cornerstone of Imperial magic. There are several places in the summoning which only may be accomplished with the aid of Irionite. Which is why we now beseech you, Master Minolin, to pledge your assistance to the Order in executing its duty faithfully, he said, bowing his head slightly. Whatever that duty might happen to be, I answered cautiously.
Yes, exactly, Osirigo said.
It may have been the most perverse use of the term I'd ever heard. I considered. What did I have to lose? They wanted to lavish me with spells and gold and resources, and all I had to do was agree to help them with the research. At worst, the Forsaken would end up arguing with Shirul over who got the biggest share of the ruins,
but there was also a chance that they could be genuinely helpful, if they even existed. If they were mere figments of historical fiction, then that might be even better. Before I could answer, the chime rang again, and it was time for the fruit course. Fresh, juicy apples, some oranges, red fruits, cherries and blueberries, again packed in snow, but sprinkled with finely ground sugar and served with a small plate of rich, subtle cheeses. While we sampled the incredible dish, a girl sang a beautiful Remiran love ballad about a pirate captain who goes to sea only to return in disguise and discover his wife with her lovers. Plural. It got kind of twisted after that. "Look, I don't see why we can't pursue this line of research," I said carefully, after I spit out the last of the cherry pits. "Especially if there's even a hope that the Forsaken can take the dead god in a fight. But it cannot be my first priority. You must understand that. I will give you what help I can, but if it takes resources away from the war, it goes to the bottom of the list. Other than that, I don't see why not." That seemed to please every member of the Order in the room. Mistress Letawandua looked like she was about to cry tears of joy. Osirigo gave me a full body hug. I've never seen people so happy about chasing an imaginary super god before. But then Osirigo called for a toast, and we got down to the serious drinking. They call it the Toast of Promise, an old Remiran custom dating from the days of the first plantations. 9 tiny china cups, each filled with different liquors. Each cup is emptied following a ritual invocation of the gods, the spirits, the ancestors, etc., to observe and bless the occasion. Remirans apparently do it at all important occasions. Everyone was served a little tray of these things. They don't sound like much, and each one was no bigger than a thimble, but downing 9 of them, each more exotic and delicious than the last, was quite an experience, especially after the wines I'd already sampled. "Now," Penny said, wiping her lips after the 9th toast, "back to business. The Order wants to donate a number of its records and scrolls, and lend its expertise, and probably some money." "Money?" she asked, slurring her words a little. Penny weighs about as much as a pregnant nanny goat. That liquor had to be hitting her. "Money," Master Gorthus assured her. "The members of the Order have been quite generous over the years." "Then let's consider a few practical matters," she continued. "First, we're going to need magi to fight the dead god. Can the Order help ensure that there is a good supply of high-quality candidates?"
"We can," agreed Mistress Letawandua. "We have several promising students. Each family would be willing to contribute a few sons to the war effort, I think."
"What about intelligence?" I asked. "You have your order, I now have mine. We have mutual political enemies. If I could count on receiving any important information about those enemies..."
"You may consider us at your disposal," agreed Gorthus. "Our members hear many secrets."
"Excellent. What about proper facilities? If we are to pursue this research project, we'll need space to work. Several places."
"The Order has many sites which may be suitable," noted Osirigo, and listed some. And it went on like that. Everything we wanted, they were happy to grant us. If this is the way Remirans negotiate, I could get used to it.
We kept negotiating through 3 more food courses and 2 exquisite alcohol tastings. About 3 hours after midnight, I was near insensible, sprawled on my couch and drooling, as servant girls continued to ply me with food and drink long after the need was sated. They didn't seem to mind roaming hands, either, as I complimented them on their charms in an increasingly friendly and intimate way. I expected Penny to show up and reprove me for taking such liberties at any time, until I glanced over at her couch and noted the husky young servant lad who had his tongue in her mouth, with his hand up her skirt. I couldn't see her hand, but I had a pretty idea of where it was and what it was doing. I smiled, drunkenly, and one of the servant girls kissed me. I thought about Alia, and missed her terribly, but then someone was lifting the hem of my tunic, and I was quite distracted. Then I relaxed, and eventually faded into oblivion. The shitty thing about oblivion? Eventually, it stops. The next thing I knew, someone was slapping my face and splashing cold water on me. My head swam and I struggled feebly until I suddenly felt preternaturally calm. Someone had cast a spell on me. I would have been resentful had it not been followed by a sobering spell of some magnitude. I felt ill for a moment and then was quite in touch with my faculties. I wasn't able to articulate that in time to keep someone from sloshing another large ewer of cold water over my head. "I'm awake!" I sputtered in protest. "Ishi's nips in the cold! What's the matter?"
"There's been news," Penny said quietly. "From Gilmora. From the front."
I took a towel offered by a servant and began drying my hair. My tunic was soaked. My attention was on Penny, however, as I felt my stomach tighten.
"Have they started their advance?" I asked hoarsely.
"Dear gods," I had to pee.
"In a manner of speaking," she sighed, "the dispatch didn't have much detail, but it didn't need to. 2 days ago, dragons descended on the garrison castles in Gilmora. All 5 garrisons were attacked. 2 were destroyed outright. The other 3 sustained serious damage. Thousands have been killed or wounded, probably tens of thousands, and the stockpiles the garrisons relied on were burned with dragon fire."
I blinked, trying to banish the stickiness in my eyes.
5 garrison castles? I asked in disbelief.
5, she agreed grimly.
"Get up. I think we need to have a quick war council."
I glanced outside. Dawn was just breaking. I glanced inside. The room looked like it had been through a very good party.
"Well, yeah,"
I agreed dully. "But what can we do from here?"
"Prepare for the politically inevitable," she said, helping me to my feet.
My knees were seriously considering not reporting for duty. I had to quickly grab my pants before they fell down too. Somehow the drawstring to my trousers had become untied. "The politically inevitable? We just endured a major military strike, and you're concerned with the politics of it?" I was confused and a little irritated.
"That's our job now," she reminded me. "The Duke, the King, will expect some sort of reassurance and response from us, since we're the only ones who have had any success with dragons.
Even if we didn't actually slay one, or really know the spell that wounded the only one we've seen," I reminded her.
"Even so, we're the only weapon the kingdom will have against them, so we have to prepare a response when the Duke, King, inevitably asks us for one."
"Penny," I said, feeling even sicker in a way that had nothing to do with drink. "We just lost a big chunk of the force responsible for keeping Gilmora safe from invasion. Without those forces, the goblins are going to be able to burrow deep into the Cottonlands, maybe as far as Barrowbell." I shook my head in disbelief. "Nearly 40,000 troops. Gone."
"Which is why Rad is going to need a well-thought-out response to the number of suddenly alarmed high nobles," she argued. "Min, think about it. 3 days ago, the only people worried about the threat of goblin invasion were those within a few hundred miles of the front. Now that dragons can drop out of the sky, hundreds of miles behind the front, or really anywhere, that's going to occur to everyone, peasant to prince. The nobility and the people are going to go mad with anxiety. They're going to demand action from their monarch, and he's going to hand the whole nasty mess to us, because that's what we're here for. So let's figure out what we're going to say, and then figure out what we can do before we're asked for it."
"That just seems like swatting flies in a burning house," I said, discouraged.
"It's practicing warfare at a higher level,"
she corrected me, as someone put a mug of something hot in my hand as we headed back to the castle.
"You can't lead from the battlefront anymore, at least not right now. You have people to do that, and they'll do a great job if you let them. But that's not what you do anymore, Min. Your job is to keep the king, or duke, or anyone else from keeping them from doing it. You keep the institutional foundation solid so that they can go out and get the job done."
"That seems like a coward's answer," I said a little sullenly, as we headed up the lane. Our various servants and retainers filed in behind us, including, I was intrigued to see, Penny's cousin, Planus.
"Cowardice and bravery are luxuries you can no longer afford," she insisted. "You have to act on behalf of your profession now, for the good of the war effort. Institutions aren't cowardly and they aren't brave. They either are or they aren't. You need to be the voice of the arcane orders, and more importantly, you need to make everyone feel like you have a real response to the dragons.
But I don't, I pointed out, irritated.
Yeah, well, don't mention that to anyone,
she said quietly, cutting her eyes at me.
That kind of defeats the purpose.
Then what do I say? What do we say? I really had no good idea. The best I had in mind was,
oops, sorry.
But I was guessing that might be impolitic. Penny apparently agreed.
Well, I don't know what the exact wording will be until we meet and agree on it, but more than likely it will say something like, the arcane orders of the kingdom are aware of the situation and have even anticipated it, although the exact nature and severity of the dragon attacks were a surprise, as was their early deployment, we are not unprepared. Building on the successful efforts of our members against dragons in the past, we anticipate being able to mount a meaningful defense against the beasts as quickly as the gods allow. Or something like that.
I blinked again. So why don't we just say that, instead of having a meeting? She sighed again.
Because some idiot is going to start asking for specifics, and I need some ideas to throw at them.
I don't know a thing about war magic, so we need to consider that. We don't know the extent of the damage or who is going to be the most upset, so we need to do a little scrying. And we now have a loyal body of magi who all happen to be at the same place at the same time, and that makes it an ideal time to have a very public meeting of the Magical War Council.
Why?
Because it makes us look like we're really doing something when we don't actually have a response to the threat yet. This sends a message of both confidence and competence when people are going to be questioning both. And that confidence will help mollify some of those who are anxious about the threat and bolster the Duke's, King's, position as a competent head of state.
He needs our help for that.
Why all the questions? She asked, annoyed. I think she was still a bit drunk herself.
Yes, he does.
His realm was just attacked from the air by magical dark forces. That's not something he can just throw a few mercenaries at and make it go away. If he can't counter that threat, or at least look like he's doing something, his senior nobles won't back his bid for the crown. That means he can't extend his royal protection to our royal charters. So he needs to look like he's doing something. So we need to look like we're doing something to make him look good and make us look good and keep everyone from going mad with worry and panicking.
Somehow I think that panicking might be more productive, or at least safer.
Doing Zack's, Penny, they're dragons!
Will you stop your whining?
She said viciously, whirling on me.
Yes, they're dragons! Last week it was goblins! Next week it will be Gyorfs, or trolls, or rogue elementals, or rabidly randy river folk! There's always going to be a nasty magical threat out there, Min, and we're the ones in charge of those now. That's what we agreed to. So quit arguing for the other side, and remember where you mislaid your testicles, because you're going to need them before the day is out.
I swallowed. I hated it when I pissed off Penny. Sorry. I'll marshal my resources and try to do better. She sighed yet again.
I know, Min,
she said, starting to walk toward the castle again.
I shouldn't blame you. I'm new to this too. I'm just trying to do things in our best interest. Looking like a bunch of market-day conjurers when it's raining dragonfire on the people's heads is not in our best interest.
I understand, I nodded, and I think I did. So we have a war council. Look like we know what we're doing, so that Rad can look important and wise, and look like he knows what he's doing. And between us, we'll keep everyone from panicking and fleeing, when that's probably the smartest move they can make.
Exactly,
she agreed, stumbling slightly. It had been a long night. So why do I feel like I'm being deceitful and disingenuous?
Because you're actually playing politics now, and people are dying. Anything you say about anything feels deceitful and disingenuous, even when you have great intentions. Study the journals of the great Arch Magi sometime, if you want to understand that.
I'll take your word for it, I said, shaking my head. Those journals were notoriously obtuse reading. But that just raises the question, what can we do against dragons except play politics?
You have an entire magical order designed to do research, she reminded me. Put them to task. They'll figure it out. If Horka could find that anti-dragon spell on his own, surely Taran and his apprentices can come up with at least one solution and manage to be where the dragons attack in time to use it. Details, she dismissed. Let's concentrate on the immediate issues first. The immediate issue turned out to be a much more detailed dispatch from Gilmora that was waiting for us when we finally finished climbing the stairs up to the keep. Azar was reading it and read it out loud to us when we arrived in Farandal's Solar, where we had agreed to meet. White Tree Castle is destroyed, and 7,000 of its men with it, he read calmly and quietly. Tantanel City, severely damaged. 4,000 mercenaries and levies killed. Hundreds more wounded. Saram Castle, leveled. 5,000 dead or wounded. Grawa Castle is destroyed. Nearly 4,000 dead. Less than 1,000 armed men survived. Nyon Castle, severely damaged. Only 1,000 dead. That's most of the Gilmoran forces, Taran said, shaking his head in disbelief. He was already in armor, as was Azar. Then again, Azar was reputed to sleep in his armor. That's nearly everything keeping the goblins from entering the Riverlands in force, observed Mage Lord Farandal quietly, as he looked at a large sheepskin map on the wall of his solar. Without the garrisons to intervene, they can plunder and pillage anywhere they can gather enough force, and there is scant defense against them. They could be in Barrow Bell by summer if they are not stopped. There are levies further south, but it will take weeks to move them up to reinforce, Taran said, shaking his head. It appears that the foe is prepared to capture Gilmora intact, with but scant defense. Over my rotting corpse, growled Azar, thrusting the parchment scrap at me. I came south with men to halt the invasion. That's what I aim to do, he said defiantly. Astaroth joined us in full armor, his mage blade peeking over his shoulder. As do I, he agreed. This makes our appearance in Gilmora all the more imperative. My apologies, Master Menelan, but our duty calls us from council. Almost, I agreed. We can spare an hour for a quick war council. Lady Pentandra has some ideas she wants to propose for your consideration, and some of these decisions may help ease the way further on. It will take time for your servants to make ready. We need to have a response prepared for His Grace. Something he can show the nobility and the people that demonstrates that we are prepared to contend with dragons, and something that will buy us some time until we figure out how to contend with dragons. That's an excellent idea, Menelan, Taran said approvingly, and we need to distribute the stones before anyone departs too. Let's convene a general meeting for later this morning. If we lend haste to it, we can have our warriors on their way before noon. It's less hasty than I'd like, Azar said grudgingly, but I will consent to delay for that long, if it is to purpose. I just want to make sure we are all in agreement before we proceed, I assured him, on the important issues. There is much left to discuss, but there will be time to finish at the Coronet Council this autumn, if we make it that far. Damn it! Exploded Azar. Had we not delayed for this useless council, perhaps we could have stopped the attack! Or perhaps you could have gotten slaughtered with the rest, observed Taran. Azar, you are not unkillable. Even Horka fell to a dragon. Had you been there, or any of us, then we would have faced the same fate. At least this way we can regroup and prepare. Yes. Consider what would have happened had the dead god attacked Robinwing, Planus pointed out, making Mage Lord Farandal grow pale at the thought. The dead god would have removed most of his deadliest foes in one strike. The rest of the war would be a foregone conclusion. I'll be sure to mention that to the widows of the 7,000 or 8,000 dead soldiers in Gilmora, Astaroth said to the Remeran mage darkly. I understand that could have been a strategic disaster. More of a strategic disaster, he said, when he saw Penny start to take a breath to reply. But that doesn't make it any better. The only real defense that the Riverlands had in place is shattered now, while we were sitting around discussing our privileges and getting drunk. If we do not arrive there in haste, then there will be little to stop the goblin advance. Then let's get this over quickly, I sighed. staring down at my food and wine-stained tunic. Rouse everyone and we'll convene presently in the Great Hall. With your permission, Mage Lord, I said, bowing to the Lord of Robinwing. Forandal had been a gracious host to us, and I would find some way to repay him, but Astaroth was right. Thinking of such things while the Riverlands burned with dragonfire made all we had done feel futile and useless. It was time for action. We can distribute the witchstones, adjourn the conclave, and prepare your forces for march all at the same time. I might even change my tunic, I said unsteadily. I realized that the sobering spell Penny had blasted me with earlier was starting to fade. The Remerans do a great job of playing politics, but the politics of the moment favored steel and fire, not food and liquor. As much fun as it had been to play at being important, it was time to get back to the depressing real world, where there were now dragons to deal with.